It all goes back to college. I worked in the computer lab in college and helping people out and that sort of thing. So I was already on the path towards assisting people, and they said, we need you to write some instructions to teach people how to do something. And I sat down, I wrote something, and they were thoroughly impressed with it. And then they made copies of it and handed it out in classes. It was so good. So I'm like, I'm good at this. And then after I graduated, I got a job doing tech support at a software company outside of Philadelphia. And after a few years working there, I started doing consulting work with them. I was on the road for a while. Not full time, but part time on the road, part time in the office. I was working at an implementation at an aluminum processing plant outside of Louisville for a summer. And I was developing training materials. I was teaching people on site. And I decided, I should get out of the tech support and start going into the technical communication because that seems to be where my skills lie. And when I came back, I transferred to development and started writing the online help.
This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring the people behind the content. I'm Ed Marsh. This is episode number 20, recorded on a very rainy October 29th, 2017. Today's guest is Timothy Esposito, Principal Technical Writer at Oracle in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Tim is also the current president of the Society for Technical Communication, Philadelphia Metro Chapter. Well, I guess let's take a step back then. You were in a computer lab. Where were you going to be a developer? What was your goal when you went to computer lab and realized that you had a different career path?
Well, I had a double major in college of both history and English. So, of course, in order to get a job, I started working with computers. I knew how to use the software for the email program, which at that point was a Unix-based system called ELM, which I believe was short for electronic mail. Yeah, you would tap into the mainframe through a hardwired little computer there, and everything was all keyboard, and it used Vi as the editor. It was great stuff, and it was not easy to use for most people, and email was new at this point in time. So I'm like, well, they said, well, if you can figure this out, why don't you work here? And so I got a job there, and I worked there for a couple of summers and then during the school year. And most of it was, reloading the toner cartridges in the printer and showing people how to print PowerPoint and that sort of thing. But, it was just a good experience helping people. In the summers, they had me rewire the lab, which sounds awesome. It's like, oh, you networked the lab during job interviews. And all I did was I laid out yards and yards of cables and snipped them and put the twisted pair wiring and then run them through the troughs. They actually handled the actual network component section. But I can say, yes, I networked the lab because I put in miles of cable.
Well, that sounds sexy.
Oh, it was great.
So did you end up with a degree in tech comm? What did you, I mean, how did you get from there to where you were in the tech comm world?
Like I finished my degree program. I had a double major in history and
Right,
English, so
okay.
my degree is in both of those. My original intent was I was going to go and become some sort of a professor or something like that. But my history advisor pulled me aside and said, "No, you don't want to do that." And I said, "Okay, I'll do it for English." And then I had a very wonderful professor who had like her undergraduate from Harvard and her graduate from Yale, and she's a PhD, and she could not find a job. I'm like, "Okay, this is not the job market I am suited to enter." So I said, "I'm going to go with technology." And then I leveraged the heck out of the job in the computer lab.
Nice. So your professional career starts out. How did you end up where you are now? Did you have a did, was there a linear path? It was a kind of roundabout. Hey, did you have a different, did you jump around? Tell us how you ended up, I guess, basically at Oracle.
Okay. So I started at a company that was called SCT, which is not to be confused with STC, which is what everyone did for a while. And they were expanding at that point in time because the economy was taking off, and it was before Y2K, and they had a Y2K solution. So they were hiring all these people right out of college. And me and a dozen other people all got hired to do tech support for this new application they were launching. It was an ERP application for the process industry. So if you made cookies, for example, you might use this software to, you know, track your purchases, where you're storing it in the warehouse, the recipes for making the cookies, how to actually cook them, how to store them, how to ship them and bill people for it. So it was a total, complete end-to-end ERP system, which was pretty cool, but it was also very, very overwhelming to implement. So they broke us into groups, and I supported the order to cash stuff, which was mainly people placing sales orders and then processing the inventory out to shipping and billing. From that, someone came up to me and said, "Hey, we would like you to develop a training class." I said, "Okay, here's something different and fun," and it gets me away from being on the phones with angry customers, let's say.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah, it was a complicated software, so there were a lot of people rushing to implement for Y2K. And so I sat down, and someone had started this project, and I polished it off and finished it, and I had developed a two-day training class on just the implementation for their pricing and promotions in that software, which was a very sophisticated module, so there were a lot of ways to configure it to get the prices right for very specific customers. And once I had this class, every month I would teach it for 2 days of the month, and then occasionally they would send me on the road to various clients to teach it on site if people didn't want to come to Malvern, Pennsylvania for the training. And from that spread to me doing the consulting gig for the better part of 6 months in Kentucky. And that was mainly consulting on that pricing application, but the application as a whole as well, from what I knew of it. Mm-hmm. And from there, I'm like, well, you know, training development goes hand in hand with the writing of documentation that people read for the instructions. And there was some turnover in the instruction writing team, and they said, "Hey, you know, you would be a really good fit for this." So I said, "You know what? I am very happy to not be answering the phone and talking to clients anymore. Let me sign up for that." And from there, I ran with it.
Nice. Well, that's cool. So did you have any Y2K problems? I was at a company, Y2K, too. It was a mainframe database company. So everyone was freaking about Y2K, but thankfully I was skiing on Y2K and up near New York State. thankfully the world didn't come to an end. But did you have any problems with that implementation back then?
No. No, it all went smoothly. They had us at that point. I had not yet transferred to the tech writing department, so I was still in support. So they had us scheduled to work over New Year's Eve. Ooh. And we were there. They brought in televisions. They had movies. It was like a big party, kind of. And of course, nothing happened. One wise guy phoned in on the action line to see if we were paying attention, and no one answered the call because we were all cheering. everything went fine.
Nice. So, well, I'm glad.
There were no problems. The only thing that went bad was after Y2K, the sales dried up because there was no more movement to get people to buy the software for a Y2K solution.
Well, okay,
and that began the downward spiral for that group, where every year they laid off more and more people until it was my turn in 2004. And they basically let go the entire tech writing team.
That's unfortunate. But, well, it sounds like you did pretty well there. And then you know, I guess you recovered, obviously. And so what happened next?
Some of the other people that had been laid off had already moved to another company that was called G-Log. And they were in King of Prussia, which is a few miles away from Malvern.
Okay.
And they said, "Hey, give us your resume. I think there's a position open." So I dropped my resume in and I got an interview and they hired me. So I worked at G-Log starting in 2005. And then by the end of 2005, G-Log got acquired by Oracle.
Okay, so what's it like working? I mean, you've obviously, you know, worked for small companies, and you know, had a startup basically acquired. How's that been as part of your career progression?
Well, it's been great. G-Log is a really great group. There was a core group of people that founded this, and I can say 12 years later, I am still working with about 90% of the same people.
Oh,
it
nice.
Had a small company startup feel to it that had stabilized and was good. They had really good software, good client base. They knew where they were going. They had great vision. They're always listed as a market leader. And Oracle saw that, recognized it, bought it, put money into it, and grew it, and we're still doing really great. And we managed to keep a bit of the small company feel to our group, even though we belong in a much larger organization.
Now, how have you managed to do that?
I think it's just it's attributed to the good leadership that we have of the vice president. All of the founders of GLOG came on and stayed part of Oracle. They're all very active and involved in everything that we do. They are still there. They are still our leaders. So it's still, like I said, the core group of people that are really driving things, and they know where we're going. And they take care of the people that work for them.
Well, that's cool. So it sounds like, well, 12 years, that's a long time. That's a pretty good that's a pretty good gig.
Yeah, it's nice.
So take it from, let's look from a process perspective. So now you've taken it from a small, company. You've been acquired by a large company in Oracle with different processes, I assume different tools. What was that like integrating your, your workflow, your day with a larger companies?
Well, it's been challenging. There's been a lot of changes in some cases, and some things stayed the same. So our core product, the documentation that we produce, was in RoboHelp.
Okay.
And it has close to 3,000 topics. It's very large. And there's not a defined Oracle replacement for that. So we've just stayed on RoboHelp. We've upgraded to later versions of it as they come out. But there's not been like a corporate mandate that all online help needs to be done in this special tool. Because Oracle has acquired so many different companies, and each one already has something already set up. So there are some general guidelines where we have to meet accessibility standards, and we're striving to do that. But they can't really say, no, stop using your software, change everything to this, because, of course, that'll take, a long time to convert things.
Yeah.
Oracle does have strict documentation standards as to how things are to be made accessible. But depending on which group you're in, they might say use tool A or tool B or tool B. You might want to use FrameMaker if you work for this group.
Okay.
This other group uses ArborText. We're using Microsoft Word because we have not really gotten the definitive go this way or go that way. So we're rolling on the way that we've been doing it.
Okay, so is your output HTML, or are you doing printed documentation, a little bit of both?
It's not printed. We distribute PDFs for like the installation guides.
Okay,
but the main documentation that the end users read is HTML based web help.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, that's interesting. But so, well, God, I can't imagine what that's like to have a company that's so large and have these different standards. I mean, I've actually. Where I'm working, we don't have pretty much any standards, but that's a different story. So I guess you're not talking. I mean, I guess you're part of a larger company, so I guess you're not talking to the other teams, or do you get to talk to other teams about what's going on?
Well, Oracle has consolidated all of the Philadelphia area companies into an outside town of Philadelphia called Conshohocken. As they acquired, let's say they had six different companies in the Philadelphia area. As each of the leases expired on those companies, they moved them into another office until we've all pretty much all been stuck into one office.
Okay.
So the bulk of my floor is actually the Primavera Group. They do project planning software. And I have several friends in that group because they sit 30 feet from me, and they're very involved in the Philadelphia Metro chapter for STC.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So we get together for lunch once a week, and we talk about, well, what's your business doing? How is your company doing stuff? How do you guys handle this? And they get different mandates because they report up through an entirely different tier in Oracle than I do. Oracle is divided into sort of like three groups based on the different CEOs that they have, and I happen to be under Larry Ellison, whereas they report to, I think, Mark Hurd, who's one of the other guys who's in charge of things. And depending on whose group you're in, you have different standards. They use WebEx for their meetings. We use Zoom for our meetings because our guy said, we're using Zoom. Okay.
Huh.
But so it's somewhat random, and I don't know why things are chosen that way. But they I think they... What do they use? Authorit, maybe, for their help documentation? It's an entirely different standard because that's what they were using when they were acquired 6 years ago. And there's a drive to move things together, but it's very difficult to take existing products and restructure them without losing how your forward momentum of development of the software. It's like, oh, you can take 4 months and bring you up to standard, or you can take 4 months and put out a better product that moves your place forward in the marketplace.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So how many people do you work with? How many people are on your documentation team? You said you have about 3,000 topics. How many people are maintaining that?
Five.
Okay.
We have two people in India and two people in Pennsylvania and one in New Jersey.
New Jersey, yes. That's the best place to be, I think, for writing technical documentation, I've heard.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So you mentioned STC, that you're on the same floor with some STC folks. You, in your email signature, you have these things listed.
Oh, good God.
STC Associate Fellow, President, STC Philadelphia Metro Chapter, Chairman, STC Distinguished Community Service Awards Committee, and Webmaster, STC Community Affairs Committee. On top of that, you were the chapter treasurer and vice president, and you also ran for treasurer of STC National. So how did you get involved with STC, and can you tell us how you got so involved after that?
Sure. So back at the old company, our manager very much suggested that we go and become involved in professional organizations. So she was aware of the Philadelphia STC chapter, and every once in a while she'd say, okay, why don't we go to this meeting? And we would all go to a meeting, and, you know, some of us were members and some of us were not, but then we would share the newsletters and that sort of thing between us. And eventually it came my turn to sign up for membership, and I had presented at STC PMC has an annual conference, and I co-presented a presentation with someone else on my team, and it went over really well, and the president of the chapter, Steve Lundgren, said, you know, I would like you to run for president for PMC next year. And I'm like, okay, I've been a chapter member for 6 months now. That seems a little premature. He's like, no. Trust me. You'll be great. And I said, okay. And this was about 2005, I think, maybe 2006. So I ran. And Lori Corbett came up and said, hey, you know, I was president in Florida. Vote for me because I know what I'm doing. And they voted for her, and she won. But she said, you know what, Tim, you're great. We need someone to start a scholarship program. That's one of my initiatives as president. We're going to start up a scholarship program. Here's the national STC scholarship program. Make a model of that and implement it for the Philadelphia chapter. So I sat down and I did that. And I did research and I found contacts at all the schools in the Philadelphia area and New Jersey, all the surrounding counties of Philadelphia. And I emailed them, and for the next 5 years, we had a scholarship program where we had students get letters of recommendation, submit entries and, you know, letters of reference, and send in their grades and that sort of thing. And we printed out giant checks and handed them out at our conference, and it was great. And then STC ran out of money, and they had to rebudget themselves somewhere around 2010. And so our funding that was coming from the society was diminished at that point. And this happened all over the place. I think Alan Hauser talked about that when you interviewed him a couple of years ago. And so as part of that restructuring, we put the scholarship program on hold. And when I was, I think I was either vice president or the first, I was vice president. We pushed to redo our chapter scholarship program and reinvent it. So the new model that we came up with was a sponsorship and scholarship program. So the idea is to try and get students more involved in professional organizations so they can apply, and up to 10 students will be selected, and the chapter will pay for their student membership in STC. Then the more interested students, they will volunteer with the chapter one way or another, whether adding stuff to the website, coming to meetings and taking attendance, that sort of thing. The ones that volunteer the most will then, we have a point system for that, and the one with the most points gets awarded a cash scholarship at the end of the year. That is written directly to the school, so it is written on their behalf, so it's not like we just give the kid money. We give money to the school in their name to be paid directly to their account. And that way we're hoping to get more students involved in the STC. If STC is going to continue to prosper, they need to really get students and younger members to come in.
I absolutely agree with that. And has that been, how has that been? Has the response been, especially now since you've revived that?
We've got some great student members that have come back even after graduation and are continuing to do stuff. We have two members in our group this year who are on our academic outreach group within my chapter, and they are networking with existing students and schools to bring more students in. We also just recently picked up two recent Drexel graduates, and they are very excited to help volunteer. They want to get some professional publications under their belt to help build their resumes and get their names out there in the business world. And
it sounds like they're motivated.
They are extremely motivated. They came to our last meeting and they were super excited. And I am very happy that they came to our chapter, and I'm looking forward to working with them going forward.
Nice. So let's talk a little bit more about your chapter. I have to say it's one of the more active chapters. I think you've had some Pacesetter awards recently. And of course you do the very nicely organized and well done Conduit conference that I have attended, I think, pretty much every year there, which is a great time. And if you're on the East Coast, please come, because it's a good time. It really is. It's a nice, intimate session. You get to meet a lot of good people. There's a lot of great speakers. But how has it been for you to have to, well, not have to, but to work with your team and the chapter to maintain that and have all that activity going on? And I know you have a lot of activities going on outside of the conference. How's it been to build that community?
It's a challenge. It all comes down to your volunteers. You need to have a good group of people. We have the process in place because we've been doing it for several years, and each year we refine it a little more and we keep a record of what we've done. We've had some really excellent conference planners the last couple of years. Things have boosted up, and as new people step up to organize the conference, they bring new ideas. And like I said, if you have good volunteers to help pull it off, okay, well, here's what we've been doing. We know how to do that. That's easy because we've got all this covered. Let's add this to it. Let's add that to it. Let's adjust the prices and have more things in the brochure packet that you get at the beginning. Let's, pens and notepads and conference memorabilia and that sort of thing. Let's up our game a little bit and bring it up. We're actually thinking about relocating the conference to another area in Philadelphia to make it more central to Philadelphia and get more students involved. It's still very preliminary yet, but Danielle Villegas, our vice president and current conference chair, she's in negotiations with one of the Philadelphia universities to see if they want to co-sponsor the conference at the university. So,
oh, nice.
It could be, a new venue, more people coming in, more student involvement, change things up. We have to investigate it to make sure that the costs line up and things like that. We've been very fortunate that we have a low cost location, so we can spend the money wisely on other items at the conference. Back in the day, they used to have the conference at a different school, and from what I remember seeing when I was treasurer, the costs were really, really high for that. But that was also back when the society was giving much more money to the chapters, so it didn't really matter. Okay. But once that funding shifted, we were on our own, so we had to shift to a lower cost venue, which is still very nice and professional, and it actually fits the group better than the old venue did. You lost the university association when you did that.
Understood. So how is it? How have you cultivated a culture that wants to volunteer and be a part of this and be, building the conference, the Conduit Conference, and the scholarships and everything that's going on in the chapter now?
I guess it's just, it's like anything else. It's who you know. So, like I said, I started out by doing the scholarship. And from there, they said, okay, you're good at this. How would you like to be the treasurer? The existing treasurer has been doing this for several years, and he wants to step down. Do you want to be the treasurer? And I said, okay. And I did the treasurer for 4 or 5 years. And then the next step was to be the vice president. So I did the vice president for a year. And then the next step is to be the president. And I'm in the second year of that. And the other people filled in is like, okay, the president's like, I'm looking for a vice president. You're the treasurer. Who do you know? And I said, I work with this woman, Jessica. She would be really good for this. And she'd been doing membership. Let's talk to her about that. Well, Jessica became the president. And she was sitting next to a young lady named Jessie Mallory. And she said, she would be a great vice president. And Jessie Mallory became the vice president when Jessica was president. And, they worked together. And then I came up and was the vice president when Jessie was president. And I'd been working with Danielle in the chapter for some time. She'd done some publicity for us and helped out with the conference. And I said, I think you'd be a great vice president. So, boom, she got elected vice president. And she presumably will take over presidency when I retire from it at the end of this year. Well, the end of this season, which goes until the end of June.
Wow. Okay. So how did you get involved with at the national level? You ran for treasurer last year. Unfortunately, weren't successful. But tell us about that experience and what prompted you to get involved in that.
Well, it actually travels back in time to 2012 when I was the beginning of my treasurership of PMC. And I submitted the budget, and they liked how I did the budget. So the society asked me to be on the budget review committee, which I didn't even know was a thing. So what happens is the society treasurer at the time was getting one representative from a special interest group, or SIG, and one representative from a community, such as PMC. And they would do conference calls a couple times a month, and they would look at all of the submitted budgets for the society. So this time of the year, every community in the society has to submit a budget. And this is how they determine how much money is given out to those different organizations. So apparently I'd done my budget really well, and they were impressed with it. So they said, okay, we want you to review everyone else's budget. So I sat down on the phone over several phone calls with Cindy Powell and Issa, and we reviewed all of these budgets. And then someone said, hey, you should run for treasurer when Issa's done. And I said, okay. And someone nominated me. There's a nomination process. And I got an email, hey, someone nominated you for treasurer. Do you want to run? So I said, sure. And this was 2012. And they did not even select me to be a candidate in 2012. But then a few years later, someone nominated me again. I never nominated myself, but other people keep signing me up for stuff. So I tried again. And I didn't get it. They screened me again. They said, you don't have enough national exposure. But they put me on the budget review committee again, so I did it a second time. And then I joined the community affairs committee, which at that point, Cindy Powell, the board member then, was running. And that's how I got involved in that, to increase my visibility nationally. And then someone, once again, I'm not sure who, nominated me to be treasurer last year. And this time I made the cut. I was on the slate. And I lost to someone that had almost the exact same credentials as me. So the nominating committee did a very good job, in my mind, of all the candidates. Because everyone, I knew almost everyone on all of the candidates. And they were all really very qualified for the job. So anyone that got elected would have been great for the position.
Agreed. So, okay, you've done all this stuff. You've volunteered. You've gone crazy with SDC. You've done with everything with SDC Philly. What are you getting out of it? Are you enjoying yourself? I mean, you've had this aspiration. You know, it's kind of like, sounds like a lot of things have kind of fallen to you, or, hey, could you do this? And you've gone and done it, but you keep on doing it. So what's motivating you to keep on doing it?
I just like helping people. If I've got a good skill set and I've got time and people need my help, I'm happy to help them. I'm somehow, as I picked up the job of the community affairs or the CAC webmaster position, the society was trying to move people to their own hosting. So the chapters and SIGs did not have to pay for hosting because the society would pay for it for them if they moved to their own host provider. And as an offshoot of that, the SDC webmaster has deputized me to assist him in any of those conversions, moving people from their old host to the SDC host. So whenever their website gets moved, I get copied on all the emails, and if they run into any problems, I help them out. So that way he's not being overwhelmed with their problems. So even right now, I'm involved with the Twin City chapter helping to revitalize their website as they convert from their old host to the SDC host.
Okay, that's cool. Yes, actually, we should talk then. I've been working to get the SDC NY Metro chapter up on the WordPress, and I've been doing a lot of testing stuff, but sounds like you're the guy I need to talk to move that over to the SDC platform.
Yeah, it's fairly straightforward. When they do that, the webmaster does the bulk of the work behind the scenes. I just help them with any incidental issues and cleanup that they may have.
Okay, so the platform is WordPress, right? Then
It is.
How have you been finding working with that?
It's been pretty good, and it wasn't on my on your list of my resume there, but for about 4 years, I was the webmaster for Philadelphia as well, while I was treasurer and vice president, and until I found someone else to step up. And that was, you know, the old person didn't want to do it anymore, and I said, you know what? I can do this. And one of our sponsors at the conference, at the Conduit Conference, gave us a book that was you know, how to use WordPress. So the president then, Steve Adler, said, hey, Tim, why don't you read this and redo our website? So I took the book, went home, read it, and redid the website. And WordPress, to me, is fairly straightforward. There's a lot of customization you can do. I try and keep things fairly straightforward and simple, so that way when someone else steps into your shoes, they are not overwhelmed with customizations.
Fair enough.
And that is often the problem that I'm seeing with the STC chapters, is that someone else set it up, and they set it up really cool, and then they left, and the new people are like, we have no idea what any of this stuff does. We're afraid to turn it off. We're afraid to update it. We're afraid to change anything.
Huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So, okay. So I want to talk to you. One of the things that impresses me, especially at this year's Conduit Conference, you're the president, you're in the chapter, you know, you're leading the day's events kind of thing. You just have such a dry sense of humor. It just made me laugh hysterically. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, part of your website, you have a website up there, and you have a bonus material section, and it points out photos of you in SDC marketing materials. What's up with that?
Oh, when I ran for treasurer, they said, you know, if you want to make your own website, that would be a great tool for marketing yourself. I think no one other than me and my family went to look at this website.
I looked at it this
week. And I said, well, thank you. But the election was last year, so it didn't help that. But so I'm like, okay, so I created this website using free WordPress, the non-hosted kind of WordPress. And I'm like, okay, well, I can put up, you know, all the papers that I've had published through STC, the book reviews that I've done, the articles that I've written, that kind of stuff. And I'm like, well, and, you know, here's all the little speeches why I want to be elected for STC treasurer. I'm like, oh, let's put something fun in here. So I had been collecting over the years little snippets of pictures that STC has put out in their emails or their the printed materials and stuff like that that you get sent that accidentally featured me in the background. And at one point they had an ad, sign up for Summit, and they had a picture of a big room with a crowd of people, and I was right in the middle of that picture. And it went out to everyone in the society, like, you know, sign up for Summit. I'm like, that's me right there. I'm famous. So I came up with the idea of STC Stealth Famous. So this is when STC unknowingly uses your image in their promotional materials. And I've actually, someone in your chapter, Julie Waxgeister, she is also STC Stealth Famous because they constantly put her up in pictures in their promotional materials as well because she sits in the front row of any conference, so they get great shots of her. So, you know, their annual report, hey, there's a picture of the back of my head walking into the room. I could recognize my backpack. There was one from Columbus where they were up in the rafters and they took a picture of the whole convention floor. And there I am with all the other people from my chapter and some new friends. We're all hanging out at some social thing. I'm like, there we all are right there. We're famous.
That's funny. I actually looked. I didn't see me in any of those photos. So I'm going to have to get more involved or at least find out where you're sitting and sit closer to you next time I'm at Summit. But it's funny.
Well, they didn't get any good pictures of me this last summer.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
Well, I did actually go to this summer, so maybe I'll get my own photo, and I could be STC famous as well.
There you go. So that was just a fun thing that, you know, people would send me pictures. Hey, you made this newsletter. You made this thing. So I just save the pictures into a folder. And I'm like, yeah, what the heck? I'll put it online for fun in case anyone actually ever browses to this page, which they won't.
Yeah. Well, I did. I found you. I found it. So I will put that up in the show notes, so that way everyone can find it on their own without having to dig too far to find it. But the other thing I found on your bonus material page, and I knew this about you, is that you're a big hiker and you were at Yosemite and Grand Canyon and Acadia National Park. Can you, you know, I haven't been hiking in a long time, unfortunately, but I also have never been on such a amazing bunch of places to go hiking. Can you tell us about your hiking experience?
Sure. When my wife and I got engaged, we took a trip to California and we drove up and down California and we went to Yosemite and to Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Park. And we didn't get much hiking because they were all just like day ventures in there. But I said, you know, these are places I want to come back to. So a few years later, I was talking to my buddy Andy, who I've known since elementary school, we went through Boy Scouts together, and I said, you know what, we're going to go to Yosemite, and we're going to climb Half Dome. I had some other friends who lived in the Bay Area, and they had done this, and I said, oh, that looks like a really cool hike. So I got some books, got some gear, and we booked a trip, you know, like 6 months in advance. And we got out there, and it had snowed 2 weeks before we got there. Even though it was May, it still snowed because it's the High Sierras, and the trail to Half Dome had not opened yet. So we did some other incredible hikes that were like 14, 15 miles, probably better views and stuff like that. So I had done all this research, so I actually wrote a little mini travel guide on, if you're going to Yosemite, here's things that you can do, whether you want big hikes, little hikes, day trips, you know, just, you know, if your parents are going to Yosemite, what sort of things should they look for? And my cousin, Mike, heard about this, and he was one of the organizers of a backpacking club based in Phoenix. And he said, you know what, I'm going to go to the Grand Canyon. You want to come with me?
Hmm.
And I said, sure. And he's like, I've got an extra ticket. Bring your friend Andy. So the two of us flew to Phoenix. And we drove from Phoenix up to the Grand Canyon, and we spent 3 days hiking down into the Grand Canyon, along the river, and then back up out of the Grand Canyon, which was quite possibly one of the most physically demanding things I have ever done. Because you're starting at about 7,000 feet on the south rim, and you're going down to 4,000 feet. And when you get to the bottom, it's not flat. It's very hilly, so it's constant up and down, up and down, up and down. And you've got 30 to 40 pounds on your back.
Right. Oh, my God.
So it's very grueling. And then to climb out, you're going up to 7,000 feet from the 4,000-foot mark. Lots of switchbacks, so you can stop and catch your breath, but it's constant cardio the whole way up. Yeah, a lot of huffing and puffing. And if you're not acclimated to the higher altitude, it's, you know, it's more huffing and puffing than you do at sea level in the Philadelphia area. The same with Yosemite. They're about the same altitudes. If you're in the valley, you start at about 4,000 feet, and to go up to the south rim there, you're going up a little bit over 7,000 feet.
Yeah, I was in Denver, God, 10 or, well, outside of Colorado. Where were we? We were in, Frisco, Colorado, and we were hiking up there. It's like 11,000 feet, and you know you have just no breath. It's absolutely insane. So I can't imagine going from 4,000 to 7,000 or 7,000 to 4,000 and back up to 7,000. That must have been, oh my God, that must have been insane.
Yeah, my cousin Mike had later went on some hikes in Sequoia National Forest or National Park, and that is up in the 11 to 12,000 range where he was. And he said he hyperventilated so much he was like seeing stars and almost passed out.
Oh my God.
And he was someone who was very fit and, you know, capable of hiking. It's just the altitude. It gets you.
Yeah. Take your oxygen, folks.
Yeah.
So Tim, you're a busy guy. I know you have a young child, a young boy. What is it that you do? You know, there's a lot going on, obviously, but is there anything else that you do when you're not talking about technical writing or your kid, your child, or you know, or hiking, basically?
I do a lot of stuff. Let's see. I'm the president of an investment club. I'm a member of my township historical commission. I write the newsletter for them because I learned how to use MailChimp for STC. And I said, hey, this group, it was a sweet little old lady who had all of the emails typed into her computer. And, you know, she would just send out a non-blind carbon copied email to 500 people announcing our meetings. I'm like, you know, there's probably a better way to do this. let me get a copy of your list. So I now do a newsletter for them.
Isn't it funny how people with their little technical knowledge default to being those kind of people?
Yeah. And I had the background with the treasurer stuff. So you're like, oh, hey, you want to be the financial manager for the township commission? I'm like, sure, why not? And I just get a budget report every month and sort of review it to make sure there's nothing egregiously wrong with it. Nothing big there. But, yeah. I don't know. What else do? I like getting together with my friends, playing new style board games, card games, that sort of thing.
So you mean like Cards Against Humanity or something different?
That is a game that we have played. That is not necessarily my favorite, but that is a good party game. there are other ones that we come back to a little bit more frequently than that. But my one group of friends, they know actual developers, and they go to special events where the people that actually make the games go and stuff like that. So they're always bringing back new and exciting things to try, which is fun.
Oh, that's cool. And I know you're also a beer guy, and actually at the last Conduit conference, you pointed me to a place called, I think, the Beer Store. And
yeah, yes,
we made it on the way home, and we spent quite a bit of time and quite a bit of money there. So I'm sure they were very happy to get our business, and it was a great recommendation. So thank you. We were very happy for a very long time after that.
That's good. Yes, you got to take advantage of a loophole in the Pennsylvania beer and liquor laws. So for those people that are not in Pennsylvania, the rules were, and it's changed relatively recently, but the rules were that you cannot sell liquor and beer in the same building. All of the liquor is sold entirely by the state in what used to be called state stores, go figure, and the beer was sold either in bars where you could buy no more than a six-pack or two, or you had to go to a beer distributor where you were forced to buy a case of beer.
It was the most insane law. It was like we went to dinner before Conduit one year, my wife and I, and we basically had to buy cases of beer to have a six-pack to have dinner with.
Right. So what the beer store did was they said, okay, we're going to get a liquor license such as we are a bar. So they have a very small bar in the back.
Ah.
And because bars are allowed to sell six-packs, they said, we're going to sell everything in six packs and singles. So you go in there and it's floor to ceiling beer, six packs and singles. You can't buy a case there because they're a bar. But they specialize in getting beer from all over the world and craft beer from all over the world. And that's why the selection there is so great.
So they took
advantage of that loophole. And since then, things have opened up, and supermarkets can sell beer now, too, because they figured this out, and they all get that same bar license, and they can sell six-packs. But none of them have had any sort of selection that I've seen anywhere close to that particular store.
Okay, now I understand, because I know just a few years ago, the Conduit Conference is in a giant supermarket, and the name of the supermarket is Giant. It's not a giant supermarket for people who don't.
And the conference is not actually in the supermarket. There's a community center upstairs from the supermarket that is a professional meeting space. It's not like we're in the poultry aisle or something.
Clean up an aisle three, conference room two.
Yeah.
So I know fairly recently that, you know, you can buy six packs there. And I was like, oh, did they change the laws? Or was it just basically they all exploited the loophole to be able to sell beer?
I believe they exploited the loophole.
Okay.
Although I think sometime in the past year, the rules have changed, and I think distributors can sell six packs now. Although I have not been into one in some time to verify that.
Okay, well, I'll have to check next time I'm in the Philadelphia area or in the Pennsylvania area.
Meanwhile, you're in New Jersey. You can go and buy all the alcohol of mixed type in the same building. You know, just hit Joe Canals, and you're all set. You're good.
Yeah, but not in supermarkets. I mean, you have to go to a dedicated liquor store.
No, not in supermarkets.
You have to go to pluses and minuses, but.
Yeah, but when you buy it in Pennsylvania, you have to ring up your alcohol purchase at a separate cash register from the ones where you buy the food.
Yeah, and there's like you can only buy like X amount at a time. So like they had to ring me up like three or four times just to be able to buy like a case of beer. It was like it's crazy.
Yeah, it's still somewhat Byzantine.
Yeah, well, hey, that's Pennsylvania, I guess. We love it. We love Philadelphia, and we're looking forward to coming. You know, my wife and I come to Conduit every year, so it's a great time and a bunch of great people and a bunch of great speakers.
We're looking forward to having
yes.
you. And, you know, we have our call for submissions out right now, so if you have anything you want to talk about, now's the time to send in what you want to speak on. We'll be making those judgments in the next couple of months and letting the prospective presenters know whether they're in or out.
Why don't we talk about that a little bit? When is the conference next year, and when is the deadline for submissions?
The conference is April 5th and 6th, or 6th and 7th, whatever that weekend is. So it would be the Friday and Saturday, and I know the 6th is involved somewhere. I don't have the calendar in front of me. The submissions deadline, I think, wraps up in December. So come up with your ideas and send them in now. You don't have to send in the entire presentation. You just need to come up with your premise and what you want to talk about and a summary of that. But if you want to come up with a 30-page slideshow, you don't actually have to turn that in until much closer to the due date.
Okay.
I know that because that's what I did a few years ago. I said, okay, I'm going to talk on this. And they said, that sounds great. I'm like, now I actually have to create that slideshow and come up with the topics. I mean, it was all in my head, but, you know, a couple of weekends worth of work, and you come up with a good presentation.
Yeah, see, I think I did it in reverse when I presented at Condu. It's like, oh, I have this idea, and here's 30 slides, and here's the deadline. So I've got all the 30 slides in, and then I change a bunch of stuff, or everything goes differently. So I guess I'm over preparing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people want to present at STC Summit, and they use Conduit or any of the other area ones like Spectrum or Interchange. That's almost like a test run for what they want to do at another conference or LavaCon as well. There's always someone who says, "Oh yeah, I've got this accepted at say LavaCon, but I want to do it in front of a test audience." And you know, okay, they come to our conference for it. So it's a good way to work things out. I know Ben Welk has been teaching a workshop on introverted leadership, and I think the first draft of that was at our conference last year. And it was a great workshop, and I know he just did it again at Interchange last week, I think. And, you know, he got the feedback from what we were doing and you know, improved it, honed it down.
Nice. That's cool. I haven't gotten to the summit level yet, but I do enjoy presenting at Condu, especially because it's such a small, intimate group. And you know, I've had revisions after presenting at Conduit. So yes, it does definitely give you that I guess dry run or you know a beta test, I guess. But even so, I was definitely prepared, and I love that the intimacy of the Conduit conference that you don't have at like a summit. I mean, you know, there's 1,000 people or whatever it is at summit, and it's great to see all those people, but you don't get that intimacy that I think you do at a smaller conference, a regional conference like Conduit.
Yeah, the rooms at Conduit are usually no more than 20, 25 people in an audience. So you can look out at them, get direct feedback, and interact with them. Whereas when you go to summit, you're in a room with hundreds of people potentially based on the size of the room. And you might get feedback from the free people in the front row, but you don't have that same dynamic.
Right, right. So, Tim, last question for you, and I believe this is our first ever listener question. This is from Twitter, believe it or not. Someone I don't know called TechCom Geek Mom. She asked how you got the Dictator for Life title at the STC Philly chapter.
Yes. So apparently my official title with STC PMC is President and Dictator for Life.
Okay.
And that title was bestowed upon me by TechCom Geek Mom, who is secretly Danielle Villegas, whom you already interviewed on this show about 2 years ago. So she is my number one minion. When I do presentations, she gets up and she bows to me in front of everyone and calls me Dictator for Life. So maybe it's a title that'll stick after I retire at the end of the year. We'll see.
So what do you have plans? I mean, what do you plan on doing after your time at Philly Metro, at the top of Philly Metro? What do you have planned next? Or don't you?
Sleeping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
I've been doing the STC PMC stuff now, like I said, since 2005. So it's like 12 years, going on 13 years. And, you know, I wasn't as heavily involved doing the scholarship stuff. But once I became the treasurer 6 or 7 years ago, things really ramped up. And it's been a really great run. And I just want to say, if anyone wants to really get ahead in their profession and make connections, volunteer with your local organizations, because you get to meet people from all over the place. Universities, other people that are members of the chapters, guest speakers, people that come in from all over the country. My networking has exploded since I've taken over leadership responsibilities in this chapter. I've got people on social media from all over the country and all over the world that are all in technical communications. So, you know, exploit LinkedIn as much as you can. I was never really big into Twitter until I started doing leadership stuff, and I'm still not super big in it, but it is a fun way to connect with some people. Facebook, I'm connected with a whole group of STC people. It's funny because it's like I went to the STC summit in Minneapolis in 2007, and I had lunch with someone who was the president of the Minneapolis St. Paul chapter out there, the Twin Cities at the time. And I came away and said, that was a great lunch. I have no idea who that person was. And then I met her at summit a few years ago, and now we're connected on Facebook and we chat all the time. And it's just, you know, small world networking. And when you get involved, doors open that you didn't even realize were closed.
That's awesome. Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree. Conferences for sure. Social media for sure. Fantastic way to get out there and meet people and peers and colleagues and then meet them, hopefully, at a place like Conduit.
Yeah.
All right, Tim. So on that note, where can we find you? Where's the best way to reach out to you?
I guess the most professional facing thing I have is Twitter. So that is TMESPOSIT at Twitter or whatever the Twitter thing is. And there's the website that you mentioned, which I think is the same thing because I branded it the same because I was all into personal branding after going to some summit sessions. So I have business cards made with one of the pictures I took from one of my backpacking trips with my face. And then I used that same image on the WordPress page, and it's the same image on Twitter, so that way if people are trying to figure out who I am, it's all the same. And I think that's it's my first initial, my middle initial, and then most of my last name without the end, .wordpress.com or something like that. You said you'd have it in the liner notes of the presentation.
We'll have all these links, Tim, at edmarsh.com/podcast. You can find me on Twitter at edmarsh and of course at edmarsh.com. You can subscribe to the content podcast on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, and the Google Play Music Podcast Store. Please do us a favor, write us a review, let people know how we're doing, let us know how we're doing. For links and more on how to subscribe, you can go to edmarsh.com/podcast. And subscribe using your favorite podcasting client. Tim, thanks again for your time. It was great talking to you. Hoping to see you again soon. I don't assume you're going to LavaCon.
No, I will not be attending.
Okay. Well, I
it's amazing. See... When you have a 2-year-old, you don't get out as much as you used to.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, I will let you go. Get some sleep, Tim.
Okay, you too.
Take care. Now everyone go out there and create some better content.
Sounds great.
Hey, thanks.